Welcome to Pro Money Talk. This week's special guest is Steve Forbes. Many of you are familiar with Steve Forbes and his body of work, but just to refresh your memory, he was a former presidential candidate. He is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. He's written several books, and he's widely known as an advocate for free market thinking.
In today's interview, Steve talks about the flat tax, which is really short for a flat rate income tax, which, for those of you that might not be familiar with that concept, would tax all levels of income at the same rate. So whatever it might be set at, 13%, 17%, 20%, everyone would pay the same rate. But a true flat rate tax would apply to everyone equally, starting with the first dollar earned. And with Steve's proposal and some of the other proposals that have been put forth in the United States and elsewhere, there is a deduction involved as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of information about the flat tax, but this is an introduction. It's also a nice pairing to one of our earlier shows that we did on the what's called the fair tax. So this will be part of hopefully a growing body of shows that tackle specific subjects, and this one would be, of course, taxation.
And I'd like to say that our shows run the gamut from specific shows on how to do things, sort of brass tacks, nuts and bolts approaches to personal financial planning and education. But we also have shows that are kind of broadly educational and conceptual like this show. And we also tackle the personal side of finance and the struggles that people go through and the characters, traits that make people successful. So really our goal is to talk about success broadly in the personal finance arena. And we'll have different kinds of shows that will appeal to different people, obviously. And past shows, by the way, are always still available on the Pro Money Talk website.
Yeah, that's www.promoneytalk.com. We have a mailing list there that you can sign up for, and every time a new show comes out, we'll send you an email to let you know. You can also write and ask us questions, and we'll do our best to answer every question. Show suggestions are great. I'd also like to mention that Peter was talking about the breadth of our topics. I'd like to hear from the listeners if they find that valuable, if they would like us to focus more or less on certain topics or certain formats of the show, because we're really here for you.
And it's especially rewarding when folks write and say how much they appreciate the show, so that means an awful lot to us. Just thought I'd throw that in there.
No negative feedback, please, is what we're saying.
No, actually, we welcome all the feedback, but the positive feedback just makes my week, I'll tell you. So getting back to Steve, I think he was an excellent guest. He's very clear, he gets right to the point. The interview is very entertaining. I can recognize when people are skilled at speaking and conveying ideas, and I think Steve did an outstanding job. I really enjoyed listening to it.
I enjoyed it as well.
There are some interesting points. I know that you covered a lot in the interview, and I'm not going to take up too much time. We'll get to the meat of the show, but I wanted to mention that there are actually five states in the United States that incorporate the flat tax or have adopted the flat tax. So in the United States, the federal income tax is progressive, which means that at higher income levels, the rate is higher, that people who earn more are taxed at higher rates. But there are five states in the United States that operate on a flat tax basis. That's Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a pure flat tax, so there's no zero bracket amount.
I think if there was a national flat tax, that we would see all the states adopt a flat tax for simplicity. A lot of states' tax codes are based on our federal tax code at some level.
Mm-hmm. And one more thing before we get started, there are great entries in Wikipedia. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, that's an online encyclopedia maintained by the world at large. It's a great resource. It's available at wikipedia.org. The flat tax entry is lengthy and informative, and there's also, of course, an entry on Steve Forbes.
Fantastic. You'll also be able to find some information, of course, in our show notes. We'll put a link in our show notes for the Wikipedia entries on Steve Forbes and the flat tax, so you can learn more if you'd like.
So with that, let's get into the interview.
Well, hello, Steve, and thank you for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Jason.
We are recording this call in California. It might be considered a hot spot for flat tax thinking. We're about 30 minutes away from the Hoover Institute. One of our future guests is Susan Woodward, and she's married to Robert Hall.
Uh-huh.
And as you know, Robert wrote the book The Flat Tax with Alvin Rubushka.
Right.
And I was reading your book, and I know you're a big fan of their work.
Yes, they were very important in getting this idea, fleshing it out, and getting it on the world stage.
It sort of leads into my first question, and that is there are several versions of a flat tax that have been proposed. Just briefly, can you give us an overview of your proposal as outlined in your recent book, The Flat Tax Revolution?
Yes. What we would do is take the federal income tax code and all of its attendant rules and regulations. As you know, the whole thing comes to 9 million words, right, compared to 5,000 words, say, in our Constitution, and the 773,000 words in the Bible, which took centuries to put together, and just start over again. The current code is beyond redemption. Right. They tried to simplify it 20 years ago, and since then we've added thousands of amendments and 3 million new words. So what we do is replace it with a single rate tax system, flat tax system, that would have high thresholds. For example, a family of four, mom, dad, say, two kids, would owe no federal income tax on their first $46,000 of income. And then anything above that level would be taxed at only a simple rate of 17%, 17 cents on the dollar. It'd be no tax on savings and no death taxes. You would be allowed to leave the world unmolested by the IRS, or as our founders would say, no taxation without respiration. And on the business side, the profits tax would be cut from 35 to 17%, and there'd be no more depreciation schedules. So if you make a capital investment, whether it's buying a PC or a factory or a piece of machinery or a truck or anything else, you would be able to treat it as an expense for tax purposes. That way you wouldn't have to try to figure out, are you eligible for a credit or accelerated depreciation, what's the useful life of the asset and all that stuff. You'd write it off, and if you had a loss, you'd carry forward against future profits until you use them up. So that way, individuals and businesses could make decisions based on whether the decision made sense, not whether it complied or took advantage or disadvantage of the tax code.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point, one that I hadn't necessarily planned on talking about. That is the amount of time and energy that otherwise productive people spend trying to beat the system, if you will.
Well, that's right. And not even just to beat the system, just to even comply with it. The waste of brain power, the anxiety, the record keeping. I mean, after the holidays, once you get over what you've spent, face the new year, you suddenly have to figure out, oh my goodness, I've got to put together records, 1099s, this form, that form, have I forgotten something? And on it goes.
And your form is a postcard.
That's right. You could literally do it on a postcard or a sheet of paper, do it in a few minutes, and this would be a good flat tax, not the IRS version. The IRS version is first line, what do you make? Second line, send it in. But this way, you could keep more of what you earn. Last year, for example, we spent 6.5 billion hours filling out tax forms, so we'd have billions of hours of brain power applied to more productive purposes, including leisure, and it would also remove a huge source of civic corruption in our society. I mean, everything we do now revolves around the tax code. Want to go on vacation? Hey, tie it into a business conference, get a tax deduction. It's corrosive.
Yeah, and certainly the flat tax is appealing in its simplicity, and it's also appealing for the reason that you mentioned, the lack of anxiety and the lack of corruption, the better transparency. But what everyone wants to know is, how does that change the rate that I pay? Am I going to end up paying more taxes?
I've designed mine so that everyone gets a tax cut, and that way we get away from sterile debates. Everyone's helped. The economy will be helped, taxpayers will be helped, and just to ensure that people don't feel that they might be euchred or suckered in some way, you have a choice. In other words, when we have the new system, you can file under the new system, or if you wish, you can stay with the old system. In other words, let people see for themselves which one is better.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really interesting suggestion that you made in your book. That is that people would have a choice. They can either file using the flat tax or they can file using the current tax system. My question about that is, does that really eliminate any of the complexity, or does that just add more complexity now that we have another system of taxation as well?
Well, I think 99% of the people would quickly see new is better. So that would simplify the lives of 99% of the people right off the bat. And this really turns upside down in a very benign and helpful way the current system we have, where we have two tax systems already, the normal one and then the alternative minimum tax, which is ensnaring millions and millions of more people each year. In other words, you take your lawful deductions and the code decides that you've taken too many, even though they're all lawful, you get penalized with a flat tax, perverse flat tax, called the alternative minimum tax. There's no alternative about it. It's mandatory, and there's nothing minimum about it. It's the maximum tax. So you figure out your tax twice, and whichever one is the higher is the one you pay in. But the flat tax, whichever one's the lower, you pay in.
So it seems to me that providing people the ability to choose either one is really a way to, I guess, ease their fears a little bit.
Well, yes, and that way people don't get caught up on, am I going to lose this deduction, that deduction, and you can argue till you're blue in the face that you're better off, but they just know what they're losing and don't realize what they're gaining. This way, I think there's a lot less anxiety. People can know they have a choice, so hey, why not try it?
So you say that everyone's going to be paying less in taxes, and yet we're going to increase tax revenue. There seems to be something missing there. How can everyone pay less in taxes and we still collect the same amount of tax revenue?
Well, because with the properly structured tax cuts, we end up with a more vibrant, stronger, innovative economy. In other words, when you reduce the burden on people, many people decide to start new businesses, take more risks, and lo and behold, we come out ahead. John Kennedy, for example, and the Democrat back in the early 1960s, proposed a 23% cut in the federal income tax, and in those days, Republicans were against tax cuts, and the criticism was this would cost the government a lot of money at a time of budget deficits. And instead, when the tax cuts were finally enacted, the economy got stronger, and tax receipts went up. Same thing happened in the 1980s. Top rate, for example, was cut from 70% down to 28%. Rates were cut across the board by 25%. And federal revenues doubled. Mm-hmm. And we've even seen with a milder version of tax cuts in 2003, almost three and a half years ago, when we had a small cut in personal tax rates, cut in capital gains and dividends, plus some incentives for businesses to invest more, what did we see? We saw an economy that doubled its growth rate. And revenues surged in Washington. Problem was they spent the money and spent some more. But that's a spending problem, not an income problem. The money's coming in.
Yeah, and in fact, I have some data here from the fiscal year ending 2006 that our federal budget deficit has actually fallen. It's fallen to $260 billion, and that's despite, obviously, increases in spending. A lot of that deficit decline has been from increased taxes from corporations, from dividends. And I know that there was a big talk about the loss of revenue for taxation and dividends when they dropped it to 15%.
Right. And instead, guess what happens? It stimulates more activity. People do things they wouldn't have done otherwise, and we come out ahead.
And you give a lot of examples of that in the flat tax revolution. And that was something that I found particularly interesting from a historical standpoint.
Yes, this is not theory. This is experience.
Now, you show in your book what a person's effective tax rate would be under the flat tax. As you mentioned, there are some exemptions. There are some exemptions for married families and for children. So it's not exactly flat. There's an effective tax rate.
Well, what we wanted to do was avoid getting criticized for increasing the tax burden on lower-income people. And also, I think there's a moral case to be made that the government should allow you to keep a certain amount of income to meet your basic family responsibilities. And so that way, again, no one can say their tax burden is going up. No one can say it's just a giveaway to the rich. Everyone benefits from it, simplicity in and of itself. So I think people can more readily sign on the dotted line.
Yeah, and to give our listeners an idea, one of the charts that you had showed that I think it was for a family of four. As you mentioned, those with income under $40,000 wouldn't pay taxes. In fact, some of them would be getting money back from the government. And at $90,000, the effective tax rate would be about 8.1%.
So it's progressive, but progressive in its simplicity. Single rate, high thresholds. And that way we don't get in the envy business or making a complex which just allows for loopholes and lobbying and all the other things we've seen for over 90 years.
Now, speaking about loopholes, a question that I have that, frankly, I've had difficulty reconciling is the fact that there's really no provision for stopping Congress from making changes to a flat tax system and putting in more loopholes.
Well, I think there are two good defenses against that. First, we have to remember that Thomas Jefferson told us that liberty requires eternal vigilance. There is no perpetual motion machine in this arena. You always have to be on guard against those who want to pick your pockets more. But the two defenses are, first of all, it's very simplicity. If you try to change it, everyone can see what you're doing. Whereas with the current code, with those 9 million words floating around, you can do things, slip in things, and it's months before anyone knows what's happened. And the other defense is the supermajority provision. In other words, if Congress wants to increase the rates, it has to do so with a 60% vote of Congress. And if you look at most of the tax increases in the last 20, 25 years, they've passed with less than 60% of the vote in Congress. So that way, the only way you can up the tax rate is if there's a true national consensus in response to a true national emergency. And that way, there's no way somebody could come in as President Clinton did when he first came into office, and he rammed it through a Democrat Congress, but he passed each house, I think, by only one or two votes. So with this supermajority provision, you can't do it unless the nation truly agrees that it's a necessity.
Pardon my political ignorance, but how is it that we can require a supermajority?
Congress can do it by putting it in its rules, which it's allowed to do. And again, once it does that as part of the bill, then to change it, public would see what they're doing. And you could raise a ruckus if they tried to change the rule. That way, you don't have to go through the laborious process of a constitutional amendment. They can pass a rule, and they do this all the time in terms of rules and bringing up bills and that sort of thing. So they can do it. And again, best defense is simplicity.
So obviously, to change the tax code, it wouldn't require a constitutional amendment. What would it require? How would we go about changing the tax code?
I think the best way is to start by asking candidates, including your own representatives in Congress, call your congressman or congresswoman and ask, what are you doing on simplifying this tax code? Why not a flat tax? Now, you'll be talking to an aide who will send you a computerized message on how delighted they are to hear from you. But if enough people start to do it, they're going to start to take notice. And we owe it to ourselves and to our country. A couple of minutes each month. Do blogs. Yeah. Write a letter to the editor. Query your senator or congressperson. That's how you start stirring the pot.
And in your book, in the appendix, you list contact information for everyone's representative, local representative.
Right. It's fairly easy to do, and most people don't think to do it. So those who do have outsized influence, like lobbyists.
And we have listeners in all 50 states, and I would second that motion and encourage people to take a minute of their time to write into their local representative and ask what they're doing. Now, another issue that always comes up is the issue of tax credits that people currently get or exemptions that they currently get that they wouldn't get under a flat tax. Can you talk about currently well-known taxes and credits? Which ones would be eliminated?
Well, we would eliminate virtually all of them except for exemptions for adults and for children. And because with those generous exemptions, you don't need all of these myriad credits. What Congress does, in effect, is take a dollar from you and then give you back 50 cents in various forms. And you're supposed to be grateful for the exchange. And this way, you get what you're owed. You don't need a tax attorney to figure out what you might get. And with choice, if you feel you have a peculiar situation, you can file under the old system. This way, you don't have to lose. You don't have to take anyone's word for it. Just see for yourself.
And I love the point that people tend to fixate on what they feel that they're going to lose. Giving people the opportunity here really does take that pressure off and allows everyone to look for themselves and see whether it's going to be better or not for them.
Exactly.
What about dividends and capital gains? Are they considered income for the flat tax?
They're considered investment savings, and so they would be exempt. Dividends, as you know, that's a form of double taxation, which they tried to get rid of 3.5 years ago and at least got the rate from 38% down to 15%. And capital gains, in effect, is taxing twice and hurts risk-taking. So this way, they're removed from the code. And one good thing from that is lower mortgage rates. You know, you look at tax-exempt bonds.
Right.
They always have a lower rate than taxable interest bonds.
Indeed.
And this way, everything is tax-free. And so with lower interest rates, guess what? Instead of paying, say, a fixed rate of 6, 6.5% on your mortgage, go down to 5, 5.5, 4.5.
It seems that this would be especially valuable for retirement savings, college savings, people on fixed incomes.
Yes, and it would, in effect, make a lot of these current vehicles now, you can keep them, but it would make them superfluous because everyone would have a Roth IRA. Everyone could set money aside and have it grow tax-free for college.
Right.
You could just do it.
Right. And those people who are in retirement and need income, when they're investing in dividend-paying securities, they're not paying taxes on those dividends.
And they're the ones who are hurt most by this kind of double or triple taxation. And another good thing, of course, is your retirement benefits, i.e. Social Security, would not be taxed.
And, of course, we've paid tax on that money already.
It's amazing. When you're working, you pay income tax on it, even though you never got it. And then they compound the felony when you retire. They tax your benefit again.
As you mentioned earlier, this isn't just a personal income tax. It's a whole system. It's personal income tax as well as a corporate tax system. And that's what we're talking about when you say that there aren't taxes on dividends because they've already been paid at the corporate level.
Right. Taxed once.
Taxed once. There are other tax strategies being floated around, and one that we did a show on maybe a year ago was this idea of the quote-unquote fair tax. So our listeners should understand what the fair tax is, but just to remind maybe our new listeners, a fair tax is essentially a value-added tax or a national sales tax that, as part of this movement, would replace the current income tax. Tell me why the flat tax makes more sense than a fair tax or a sales tax.
Well, a sales tax would obviously be better than what we have today, but it does have certain challenges. One is the rate itself. The actual tax rate proposed by its proponents is 30%, not the 23% that's advertised. It's actually 30%. So you go buy a new house and you pay a 30% tax on it. That psychologically is a real hurdle. Even though you could argue about embedded income taxes and everything else, when people hear that 30, their backs go up. The other thing is compliance. It's one thing to put a huge tax on a product, which you can physically track, quite another to put it on a service. Say a kid cuts your lawn, be very easy to wink and nod, pay some cash, and avoid that 30% tax. And then there's the challenge of what is a business. When you, say, go to Home Depot, you buy some lumber, you say you shouldn't pay the 30% tax because you're going to sell the furniture you're going to make on eBay. Who's going to go check up whether you those chairs are sitting in your kitchen or whether they were actually sold on eBay? And then they also assume that the government is going to pay the 30% tax. So if the Pentagon buys an aircraft carrier, I'm not sure the Pentagon's going to pay a 30% tax on that.
And obviously the idea of a sales tax or value-added tax has been around for a long time. Many of our states have that, some of them along with an income tax. Like here in California, we have the dual taxation system. And in Europe, obviously, they do a lot with the value-added tax. It seems that when the value-added tax gets to a pretty high level, like this 23 or 30%, what we were talking about before, people trying to, quote-unquote, beat the system, there's really a lot of that. It spurs sort of a black market.
Yes, when a rate, a sales tax, gets above a certain level, say 10%, compliance becomes extremely difficult. And the other thing is, you mentioned a very good point, most states do have both an income tax and a sales tax. And what that means is that if you want to have a comprehensive sales tax to replace the income tax, you better be sure you repeal the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which allows an income tax. If you don't repeal that amendment, I guarantee you, eventually in this country, we'll have on the national level, which you have in most states, both an income tax and a sales tax.
And you make the argument in the book, it's a very short argument, but obviously it's incredibly difficult to repeal an amendment. So it's pretty
easier to go to a flat tax.
Play devil's advocate on that. There's an argument that it flattens out the ups and downs of revenue to have a dual tax system, in that there are times when earnings are high but spending is low, and there are other times when earnings may be lower but spending is still high.
Well, I think the view should be the tax systems are to finance government and needed services. But the government is supposed to serve the people. People aren't there to serve the government. And if the government has problems because it can't control its own spending, the people should not have to suffer for that. And the nice thing about flat tax is that if you, say, get unemployed, you don't pay a tax. Whereas if you have a sales tax, you pay it whether you're employed or not employed, whether you're rich or poor.
It's actually one of the arguments against a flat tax by those who haven't taken the time to really study it is that it's a burden for the poor and that they're paying the same rate as the wealthy, which on the surface is true. But as we talked about with the allocations that you make, the effective tax rate is quite different. But in a sales tax, there's none of that, or it's very difficult. There's been some talks on the fair tax to try and get around that, but it would create more of a bureaucracy.
Yes, because they have this idea of rebates, but my goodness, you know what kind of bureaucracy as you need to determine who should get the rebate. Are you eligible, or are you a legal alien or illegal alien? It just becomes a morass.
Yeah. I guess the fun part is trying to decide what we do with all the free time and all the people who are now available to be productive in society.
I think we would come out ahead. People would enjoy the time, and I am a compassionate conservative, so I wouldn't object to job retraining for lobbyists and IRS agents.
Could we turn them towards the government and have them do audits of government spending?
Now, that's a good idea. That's an excellent idea. And audit the expense vouchers of congressmen. That would be good.
In your book, The Flat Tax Revolution, you also talk extensively about countries that have been experimenting with the flat tax. And in fact, Hong Kong, which has had a form of flat tax for quite a while. Can you give us an update on how well some of these countries are doing with their flat tax system?
They're doing very well. Everyone that's tried it has found it to be a real success. Hong Kong, as you mentioned, has done it for 60 years successfully. Estonia, a little country in former part of the Soviet Empire, now a vibrant country, put in a flat tax in 1994, and it's been a roaring success. That's a very fast-growing country. Even the Russians put it in 5 years ago, and it's been a success. In the first year, their revenues went up over 25%. So where it's been tried, it's worked out very well. And there are a number of countries that have done it, a number of countries that are actively examining the thing today.
What I found fascinating is that as we become more of a global economy, there really is a competition for jobs, there's competition for industry, and a lot of the countries that are turning to flat tax and to taxation systems that appeal to the worker and taxation systems that appeal to companies and corporations are countries in the former USSR, and it seems that they're getting quite a bit of industry from Western Europe, which hasn't had a lot of competition in a long time.
Well, I think it was Walter Wriston, great banker, now deceased, once said, he said, capital, and he meant by that both money and people, go where it is welcome and stays where it is well-treated. And these countries have looked at countries like Ireland, which in two generations, Ireland went from the poorest economy in Western Europe to now the most vibrant economy in Western Europe. And countries look at that and say, hey, we're behind, we want to move ahead, and how do we do it? And one critical way of doing it is slashing the tax burden and making yourselves attractive for investment. And guess what? Positive things start to happen.
Yeah, and you mentioned Ireland, and that's been an amazing success story. And it seems thus far the countries that you mentioned in your book, I think the Ukraine was just underway with the system when you wrote the book. It seems that they're having quite a bit of success. And you see some of the socialist countries, France and to a lesser extent maybe Germany, struggling with open borders and the ability of companies to relocate to areas with more favorable tax systems.
And one of the positive things, I think, that's coming out of these countries that are putting in the system is it's forcing their neighbors to reconsider. Austria, for example, a few months ago substantially cut its corporate tax, business tax. Why? Because neighboring Slovakia cut theirs down to 19. So the Austrians, even though they weren't supply-siders or didn't understand incentive economics, realized they were going to lose business, so they had to adjust.
to a certain extent, we've maybe been a little bit isolated here. Obviously, the United States has been the leader in capitalist thought for quite some time. But if you look at our neighbors, particularly in Latin America, they've been burdened with pretty inefficient economic systems for a while. And of course, Europe is an ocean away and Asia is an ocean away. So we've had this insulation for a while, but that's starting to erode. And we're seeing a lot of talk about that in the media and a lot of concern about a smaller world, if you will.
Yes, and the bottom line of the whole thing is that no matter what your size, no matter how badly or well you've done before, if you positively reform tax system, and remember, taxes just don't raise revenue for governments, they're a price and a burden on people. If you lower the burden on people, people do more, and we all come out ahead.
It's my opinion that we need to stay competitive and stay a step ahead. Now, why is it so hard for us to pass the flat tax? Why the resistance?
I think, first of all, it's a relatively new idea, even though it's been around for a while. People haven't had a full discussion of it yet. I think critical reason is that politicians find they're very happy with the status quo. It's a great source of contributions, having a complex code, so they don't want to mess with that. So you have special interests. When I ran for president 10 years ago, for example, in the state of New Hampshire, H&R Block sent a mailing warning of the impending end of civilization if we got something like a flat tax. And then there's the ideology, the idea that if you earn more money, you shouldn't just pay more, but you should pay a higher rate. We don't have that philosophy on sales taxes. We don't have that philosophy on property taxes. But they certainly have this notion that it's right to do on people's incomes.
So we're battling some of our own perceptions, but we're also battling a lot of people who have vested interests in keeping the system as it is.
Exactly.
I wanted to make a quick comment. Just recently, we lost a giant in free market thinking in Milton Friedman.
That's right. He was one of the most influential figures of our time. He had a brilliant mind, but he also was superb in getting points across to the public. Milton Friedman was also a man of courage in that he wasn't afraid to take very unpopular opinions among his colleagues. He was considered something of a crank or a nutcase, but he stuck to it. And now a lot of his thinking is mainstream thinking. He was one of the pioneers of the idea of school choice. In other words, the purpose of an education system should be educating the child and not a special interest. And therefore, parents should be able to move their kids from schools they don't think are right for their children to schools they do think can do right by the kid. And that kind of system, choice system, helps most who start life with the least. If you're from a poor family and you're forced to go to a school that doesn't give you a good education, by golly, you've got some big hurdles to overcome.
Indeed, and that's one of the things that's, I think, frustrating for a lot of us is that we see ideas like the flat tax and the school vouchers, and it's so often presented that it's going to hurt the people with the least when, in fact, those are the people who absolutely have the most to gain. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to sit and talk with us.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed hearing that interview. I think you did a great job with him, Jason.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And we're really grateful to Steve Forbes for taking the time to speak with us, and I think his points are interesting and should be considered as a possibility. Well, I was doing a little bit of research on the flat tax and so on. I ran across something interesting. Your favorite economist, Milton Friedman, who passed away, I think, in December, had an interesting proposal back in 1962, and he called it the negative income tax.
Negative income tax.
Yeah, and it's kind of like what it sounds like, but it's a variation of a flat tax. Except that it does include personal deductions, but when the deductions exceed income, you would have a negative income.
And you would get paid by the government? Is that the idea?
That's what it comes down to. You'd still you'd apply the flat tax rate, mm-hmm. if it was 17%. If you had negative income of $10,000, and then you'd get a $1,700 refund from the government.
Wow. If I remember that correctly, I think part of that plan, he would abolish Social Security. And so this would be a way to compensate for that, possibly.
Yeah, we just get so used to thinking of things in a certain way that this really opens up other possibilities.
And people who are down and out can get some Social Security. But because there are two competing systems, you get Social Security, and then you're taxed on the Social Security, and you're paying it back in. It's very inefficient. I think Milton Friedman's idea is certainly a lot more efficient than the current system.
Well, I'd also like to say a little bit about the Success Story project that I've got going. Our last episode of Pro Money Talk was dedicated to a success story that went a little bit longer than some. And I'd love to get feedback on what y'all thought about that show, if that seems like a helpful kind of a thing, or what kind of stories you'd like to hear, or if you or someone you know has an interesting story to share about personal success with money. Again, go to promoneytalk.com, click on Contact Pro Money Talk, and I'd love to talk to you, interview you for the show. I've done a few interviews so far, and I've been amazed at how resourceful and insightful people are when it comes to the money part of their lives. It doesn't have to be a success story where the person's living in a mansion and has two Mercedes, you know, for every day of the week. It's just where people have been innovative and are beginning to reap the benefits of some decision or action they've taken, something they've learned, something that they've accomplished. We have several more snippets in our audio bank to play for later. Some of them, the shorter ones, will just append as a segment to a regular show, and some of them will be longer and they'll be standalone shows. But it's a personal project that I believe in, and I know I'm learning from it.
Yeah, and it's a really nice addition. In some of our shows that are maybe a little bit shorter, we'll be able to play one of the shorter clips. And for some of the clips that are longer, we'll be able to put them in between shows. So it's really an addition to what we're trying to do here. And I think it makes a nice addition.
Well, we know from working with clients that facts are only part of the deal, you know, that what we call the exterior part of finance, or the part that's outside of us. But you can have all the facts in the world, but if you have anxieties or phobias or belief systems that don't serve you, then, you know, all the facts in the world aren't really going to help.
Well, the ones that I particularly enjoy are shows where people have taken sound financial thinking, put it into practice, and been able to change their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the personal story aspect of it as well, and seeing the benefits and hearing the tone of people's voices. So podcasting has got that advantage over the printed word.
Well, I'd like to mention one more thing before we get off the air here. And of course, we have a community of listeners, and we really enjoy hearing from, and we appreciate talking to. One of our listeners, longtime listener, Greg Madison, started his own podcast. And in fact, it's a video cast. Greg and his wife are particularly interested in green design. They're attempting to build their own house with green designs. Greg has a show called Green by Design, and you can find it at Green by Design. That's G-R-E-E-N by Design, DESIGN.TV. And it's a video cast, and I really enjoyed their first video cast, so check it out.
Cool.
For those of our listeners who want more information or to have links to some of the topics that we discussed in the show, make sure to go to our website, promoneytalk.com, and look at the show notes. Also, while you're there, you can sign up for our mailing list, and we will email you reminders when new shows are up and what the topics are. You can also write in and ask us questions. Until next show, here's to your success.